Hello, this is Cheryl Krieger, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 8th issue of the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the headlines, Trump pardons major drug traffickers despite his anti-drug rhetoric. The president has granted clemency to about 100 people accused of drug-related crimes during his time in office, a Post analysis shows. By Merrill Cornfield and Emily Davies. On President Donald Trump's first full day in office this year, he pardoned Silk Road founder Ross Ulbricht, who was convicted of creating the largest online black market for illegal drugs and other illicit goods of its time. In the months since, he has granted clemency to others, including Chicago gang leader Larry Hoover and Baltimore drug kingpin Garnett Gilbert Smith. And last week, he pardoned former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had been sentenced to 45 years in prison for running his country as a vast narco state that helped to move at least 400 tons of cocaine into the United States. Overall, Trump, who campaigned against America's worsening drug crisis and promised to crack down on the illegal flow of deadly drugs coming across the border, has pardoned or granted clemency to at least 10 people for drug-related crimes since the beginning of his second term, according to a Washington Post analysis. He also granted pardons or commutations to almost 90 others for drug-related crimes during the 4 years of his first term, the analysis showed. At the same time, Trump has threatened military action against Venezuela over accusations that the country's government is supporting the drug trade and has pushed the Pentagon to conduct targeted strikes on boats suspected of smuggling drugs in the Caribbean. The contrasting actions have come under fire from Democrats and other critics who say Trump's broad use of clemency contradicts promises to get tough on drugs. President Trump is claiming to be taking action to stop the flow of narcotics into the United States, Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat, Virginia, said on the Senate floor Tuesday, describing the crimes of Ulbricht and Hernandez. How does this protect Americans from the flow of narcotics entering our country? Asked about the contrast, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said the pardon of the Honduran president doesn't make it difficult to defend the administration's legal strikes on suspected drug traffickers. I think that President Trump has been quite clear in his defense of the United States homeland to stop these illegal narcotics from coming to our borders, whether that's by land or by sea, and he's also made it quite clear that he wants to correct the wrongs of the weaponized Justice Department under the previous administration, she told reporters last Monday. Asked about Trump's spate of drug-related pardons and commutations, White House spokeswoman Abigail Jackson told the Post that Trump had exercised his constitutional authority and she attacked former President Joe Biden. The only pardons anyone should be critical of are from President Otto Penn, who pardoned and commuted sentences of violent criminals, including child killers and mass murderers. And that's not to mention the proactive pardons he signed for his family members like Hunter on his way out the door, Jackson said. Trump and his aides have baselessly claimed that Biden's staffers routinely used an auto pen to sign pardons and other documents without his knowledge. Trump has wielded one of the greatest powers of the presidency, clemency, far more this year than he did in his first term. He has pardoned almost all of the approximately 1,500 January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol attack defendants. He also pardoned about a dozen members of Congress, mostly Republicans, including most recently Representative Henry Sueller, Democrat, Texas, who was charged last year with bribery, money laundering, and conspiracy. By comparison, Trump granted clemency to more than 230 people in his first term, just two of those in his first year. The pardon frenzy has given rise to a lucrative cottage industry, the Post previously reported. Public disclosures show that lobbyists have spent more than $2.1 million this year on firms that advocate for pardons, clemency, and other forms of executive relief, more than double the total spent in 2024. The records also show that individuals seeking pardons have paid up to $1 million to hire people close to the president to plead their case. Experts say the administration's efforts to strike boats near Venezuela have not proved effective in limiting the flow of drugs entering the country because the passage is not ordinarily used to traffic drugs to the United States. Drugs containing fentanyl, which have contributed to most recent drug deaths, are typically manufactured in Mexico and smuggled into the U.S. across the land border. The administration has not provided detailed evidence that the boats they have sunk had drugs on board and were heading for the United States. The administration has claimed that the strikes are an effective deterrent for other drug traffickers. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters last week that they paused the strikes because it's hard to find boats to strike right now, which is the entire point, right? Deterrence has to matter. However, experts say there is no available evidence to support the theory that trafficking is down. Drug trafficking is like water, said Regina LaBelle, a Georgetown University drug policy professor and former acting director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. It's going to find a way to get in. Critics of the war on drugs have also long asserted that the government has insufficiently addressed the root causes of deaths in the U.S., addiction. Advocates have urged the government to invest more in overdose prevention measures such as naloxone and treatment options. The rate of overdose deaths has been on the rise for decades, fueled by fentanyl since around 2015 until the end of Biden's term when the rate declined. Advocates warn that cuts to Medicaid and government-supported treatment options could lead to an increase. The Drug Policy Alliance, a left-leaning group, has estimated that at least $345 million was cut this year from federal programs that fund addiction and overdose prevention services. At a time where escalating these military campaigns and divesting from this health infrastructure, it highlights the contradiction in claiming that these military actions are saving American lives from overdose, said Thesha Nado, the Drug Policy Alliance's Managing Director of Foreign Policy Advocacy. U.S. officials have long asserted that Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro conspired to traffic drugs into the U.S., formally indicting him in 2020. Secretary of State Marco Rubio cited the indictment in a Fox News interview on Tuesday, emphasizing that it was handed up in the Southern District of New York and arguing that it was undisputed. Until the president decided to do something about it, no one disputed that Maduro was in the drug trafficking business, he said. Hernandez was also indicted in the Southern District of New York. Jeffrey Singer, a drug policy expert at the Cato Institute, said Trump has been all over the map on drug policy, pointing to Trump signing a law last month that stiffened restrictions on hemp, a form of the cannabis plant, after saying he backed Florida's ballot measure to legalize recreational marijuana when he was a candidate. There is no consistency, Singer said. He pardons a drug trafficker but orders the shooting on site of drug traffickers who are not in this country. In fact, based on that logic, it makes you wonder, why are we wasting our time arresting people in this country for drug trafficking? Why don't we just shoot them? Several Republican lawmakers also expressed skepticism about the Hernandez pardon. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican, North Carolina, told reporters Tuesday that he thought it was a horrible message. It's confusing to say, on the one hand, we should potentially even consider invading Venezuela for a drug trafficker, and on the other hand, let somebody go, Tillis said. Trump and the White House have attributed several of his recent pardon decisions to an assertion that criminals were treated unfairly, part of the framing of Trump's view that the justice system has been weaponized against him and others. Trump posted on Truth Social November 28th that he had been told by many people that I greatly respect that Hernandez had been treated very harshly and unfairly. Liz Oyer, who served as the Justice Department's pardon attorney under Trump before he fired her, said presidents have long used their clemency powers to shorten the sentences of nonviolent drug offenders who have served substantial time and shown signs of rehabilitation. But Hernandez does not meet that standard, she said, noting his brief time behind bars and the lack of evidence that he has accepted responsibility for his crimes. The pardoning of drug kingpins is virtually unheard of, said Oyer, who was fired after she said she refused to restore gun ownership rights to actor Mel Gibson. Hernandez's pardon, along with Trump's decision to pardon Albrecht, underscores what Oyer described as the erosion of the traditional clemency vetting system, replaced by a process increasingly shaped by money, access, and political influence. For decades, pardons and commutations were reviewed by career Justice Department officials charged with assessing whether applicants merited a second chance. While presidents of both parties have sidestepped that system to benefit allies, Oyer said that the breadth and depth and consistency of Trump's interventions mark a departure from past practice, amounting to a parallel clemency pipeline that largely bypasses the safeguards meant to prevent abuse. Longtime Trump ally Roger Stone, who also received a pardon from Trump after being convicted of lying to Congress about interference in the 2016 election, wrote in a blog post that he forwarded a compelling letter from Hernandez to President Trump because a review of the case led me to the clear conclusion that the charges against Hernandez were both politically motivated and false. In a text message, he denied receiving any money for his advocacy. Former Libertarian Party Chair Angela McArdle advocated for Albrecht's pardon and is seeking pardons for others convicted of crypto-related crimes. She said she thought Trump granted Albrecht's release because it was an olive branch to the third party that he campaigned to vote for him and a big middle finger to the people who wanted Ross locked up. I think he understood that Ross Albrecht was a political prisoner, she said. It was the same Southern District of New York that locked Ross up that went after President Trump. And continuing from the headlines, Paramount launches hostile bid for Warner Brothers, challenging Netflix deal. The David Ellison-run company is promising Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders a deal it says is more lucrative and easier for the Trump administration to approve. By Scott Nover. Paramount Skydance launched a hostile bid to buy Warner Brothers Discovery mere days after Netflix struck an $83 billion deal to acquire the media conglomerate, Paramount Skydance said Monday. Paramount Skydance, which took shape earlier this year under CEO David Ellison, said it would be bringing a superior offer directly to Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders in an unsolicited or hostile bid to buy the company. Ellison is the son of Oracle co-founder Larry Ellison, one of the world's wealthiest people and a friend and supporter of President Donald Trump. Trump on Sunday said he would be involved in assessing the intended Netflix-Warner Brothers Discovery deal, saying Netflix's market share in the streaming sector could be a big problem. In a news release Monday, Paramount Skydance said its bid offers superior value and a more certain and quicker path to completion to Warner Brothers Discovery shareholders, an offer sweetened by $18 billion more in cash, the company said. We believe the WBD Board of Directors is pursuing an inferior proposal which exposes shareholders to a mix of cash and stock, an uncertain future trading value of the global network's linear cable business, and a challenging regulatory approval process, David Ellison said in a statement. We are taking our offer directly to shareholders to give them the opportunity to act in their own best interests and maximize the value of their shares. Netflix declined to comment. This is a developing story and will be updated. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the science section, the quest to slow aging leads scientists into the powerhouse of cells. Texas A&M researchers create mini mitochondria factories using tiny nanoflowers by Mark Johnson. Aging taps us on the shoulder in many ways. Wrinkles, thinning hair, loss of flexibility, slowing of the brain. But the process also unfolds at a more fundamental, microscopic level as the energy source inside most cells deteriorates. Scientists at Texas A&M University have discovered a way to recharge aging and damaged cells, an innovation that could lead to better treatment for a variety of conditions, including Alzheimer's disease, muscular dystrophy, and fatty liver disease. All cells, except those in red blood, get their energy from mitochondria found in the fluid that surrounds the nucleus. Sometimes called the powerhouse of cells, the mitochondria play an important role in fighting viruses, starving parasites, and synthesizing amino acids, sex hormones, and other important chemicals in the body. As people age, their mitochondria diminishes, a primary or secondary contributor to multiple aging-associated disorders, neurodegenerative diseases, and metabolic conditions such as diabetes, according to Akhilesh K. Gaharar, a professor of biomedical engineering at Texas A&M and one of the authors of the study, recently published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Gaharar and his colleagues created mini mitochondria factories by adding microscopic flower-shaped particles called nanoflowers to a lab dish containing stem cells. The nanoflowers, which are 600 to 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair, get taken into the stem cells through a natural process similar to the way cells absorb nutrients. The nanoflowers are made from an inorganic compound called molybdenum disulfide, which is able to trigger the process cells use to make more mitochondria. However, nanoflowers enable the stem cells to produce double the normal amount of mitochondria, which they then transfer to ordinary aging or damaged cells. Mitochondria experts said the study represents an important advance. The fact that you can increase the number of mitochondria per cell is huge, said Daria Moakley-Rosen, a professor in Stanford University's Department of Chemical and Systems Biology, who was not involved in the study. Moakley-Rosen, who co-wrote a book on mitochondria called The Life Machines, How Taking Care of Your Mitochondria Can Transform Your Health, said her own research led her to conclude that knowing what mitochondria can do for us can change the future of medicine, and I think the new study is an example of that. The process described by the Texas A&M team exploits the natural ability of battery-like mitochondria to transfer from one cell to another. We are supercharging stem cells so they can donate these batteries to damaged cells at a much higher rate, Gaharwar said. The stem cells, he said, have a homing ability. Whenever they see damage, they go and settle down over there, and they basically try to regenerate the damaged area. Scientists carried out the procedure using different cell types in a lab dish. Gaharwar said he and his colleagues hope to begin testing the technique in rats in January or February. The method would need to show safety and effectiveness in clinical trials before it could be used to treat people. Existing medications can increase a patient's mitochondria, but most don't change how the cell produces or maintains mitochondria. As a result, the treatments must be taken multiple times. If the new method receives clinical approval, doctors could use it to supercharge a patient's own cells, Gaharwar said. The patient's skin cells, for example, could be removed and reprogrammed into stem cells, the raw building materials that develop into skin, bone, cartilage, and blood. The stem cells could then be supplied with mitochondria-boosting nanoflowers in a lab dish and given back to the patient. The newly energized stem cells would circulate through the body, providing mitochondria to stressed or damaged cells. Having new mitochondria could help aging nervous system cells communicate better. In a person with diabetes, the addition of fresh mitochondria could help cells process glucose faster, Gaharwar said. His lab is collaborating with three other labs that specialize in muscular dystrophy, fatty liver disease, and nervous system disorders. Moakley Rosen said she wondered whether the nanoflowers themselves could trigger mitochondria growth without having to be used in stem cells. Provided that the nanoflowers are safe, she said, perhaps they could be injected in a specific area to help injured or stressed cells achieve faster wound healing. She said it would be important to pinpoint how long-lasting the benefit is from this method of boosting mitochondria. Keisha K. Singh, founding editor-in-chief of the journal Mitochondrion and director of the Cancer Genetics Program at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, called the study promising, but cautioned that it is still in the early stages. Singh, who is not involved in the paper, said the long-term safety of molybdenum disulfide in humans is unknown. Singh established the nonprofit Mitochondria Research and Medicine Society and founded a Birmingham-based company called Yuva Biosciences. The company has developed products that restore the function of mitochondria to fight hair loss and wrinkles, but Singh dreams of starting what he calls a human energy project. Improving mitochondrial function can be really extend life and health, he said. The goal would be to protect, sustain, and generate new mitochondria, he said, and do it for every organ. In breaking news, Trump to announce $12 billion tariff relief for farmers. Farmers, particularly those who produce soybeans, have felt the impact of the president's tariff policies. By Mariana Alfaro. President Donald Trump on Monday plans to announce a $12 billion relief assistance package for farmers, according to a White House official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss plans that haven't been made public. The group, a key segment of the president's base, faced fallout from Trump's tariff policies, which have heavily impacted the American agricultural sector. Trump will hold a roundtable event Monday to discuss the aid package alongside farmers, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Agricultural Secretary Brooke Rollins, and lawmakers, the White House official said. Per the official, up to $11 billion of the aid would go to the Agricultural Department's newly designed Farmer Bridge Assistance Program, created to support American crop farmers. The remaining $1 billion will go toward aid for commodities that the FBA does not cover. Farmers nationwide have been grappling with low crop prices and challenging tariffs that have pushed many into bankruptcy. As the Washington Post reported in October, some 181 farmers filed for bankruptcy protection in the first half of the year, a 60% increase from the previous year, and the highest six-month reading since 2020, according to U.S. court records. The new assistance package is expected to particularly help soybean farmers, who have seen a precipitous drop in sales this year. China, in response to Trump's tariffs, stopped buying U.S. soybeans in May after being the top purchaser in 2024. That left U.S. farmers with extra supply, and the price of soybeans fell. This is a developing story and will be updated. And from the most read section, SNL cold open mocks Hegseth as trigger happy, Trump as tired. Melissa McCarthy returned to host for the sixth time by Ethan Beck. Saturday Night Live leaned on old reliable moves this weekend. Melissa McCarthy, who won the Emmy for Outstanding Guest Actress in a Comedy Series for the last time she hosted, showed up for her sixth appearance as host. And in a broadly holiday-themed episode, SNL kicked off in a familiar place, a news conference with a member of the Trump administration. Weekend Update co-host Colin Jost played Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth as if he were headlining a metal show, with walkout music booming and an energy drink in hand. "You got questions for me?" Joss asked. Hegseth rumbled, "Fine, pretend I'm a random fishing boat and fire away." In Joss' face-off with a handful of reporters, the Hegseth stand-in was asked about reports that he'd ordered a second strike on a boat allegedly smuggling drugs in the Caribbean Sea, killing survivors of an initial strike who were struggling to flip their damaged boat. "That kind of cruel, heartless act has no place in Operation Kill Everybody," Joss responded. Joss depicts Hegseth as an uber-macho alcoholic with deep disdain for the press. "Now are we done here?" he barked at reporters. "I'm actually worried I'm going to catch dork from you nerds." Sticking with tradition, in the 51st season of SNL, James Austin Johnson joined Joss in the cold open, playing President Donald Trump. Responding to a question on why the president is distancing himself from the embattled secretary, Joss bellowed, "President Trump has my back 100%. You want to know why? Because unlike you beta cucks, he's a high-energy alpha who trusts me and listens to me no matter what. Isn't that right, Mr. President?" The camera then panned to find Johnson propped up in a corner, slack-jawed and sleeping. "Oh, stop. Stop, Mam Danny," the president says, referencing Trump's surprisingly warm Oval Office reception of New York City's incoming mayor, Zoran Mamdani. "You can freeze my rent anytime." Once Johnson as Trump woke up, Joss quickly covered for him, asserting that everything you do that's weird is a joke. But after being asked another question, Johnson had fallen asleep. McCarthy gets physical. McCarthy didn't have a TV series or movie to promote, but she's a fan favorite, so no one is going to question her presence at Studio 8H. For the monologue, McCarthy kicked things off talking about the wonder of December in New York, filled with friends, family, and classic Christmas music. To offer a taste of the season, she shared a rendition of Carol of the Bells on the mouth horn, which she split the difference between a fart sound and a chicken clucking. Keeping with the absurd, McCarthy asked for a little bit of snow to get us in the holiday mood before a truckload of fake snow dropped on her head. As she tried to get things back on track, Marcelo Hernandez wheeled a piano on stage, pushing McCarthy out of the frame in the process. Hernandez then pulled the instrument back to center stage, pulling McCarthy flat onto the piano bench. McCarthy got upset over supposedly ruining Christmas, so Kenan Thompson encouraged her to do a mouth horn rendition of "Christmas, Baby, Please Come Home," concluding one of the most slapstick SNL openings in ages. SNL goes home for the holidays. SNL has two episodes remaining before Christmas, but that didn't stop it from leaning into the seasonal theme. McCarthy is at her best in an unhinged register, which was clearest during a pre-recorded parody of a Treasley Holiday television commercial. The sketch focuses on a young man, Teddy, who wistfully spots an elderly neighbor, McCarthy, in need of help shoveling. When Teddy gets bullied, McCarthy encourages him to respond with violence and orders strippers to cheer him up. Another segment saw McCarthy and Bowen Yang as a snooty Yonkers couple who shared a progressively more outrageous display as part of a cable news feature on the biggest Christmas village in Yonkers. In an absurdist sketch, complete with auto-tune, an electro-pop beat, and VHS quality, Jane Wickline and Veronica Slowitzka shared a musical bit about Cousin Planet, where cousins exist once the holidays are over. McCarthy, as the mayor, explained that Cousin Planet is one giant cul-de-sac. Most critically, she says, there are only two laws on Cousin Planet. One, no hooking up, and the second law is that your first law is flexible. To ease confusion, McCarthy adds, use your discretion. The evening's musical guest was Dijon, and even if you didn't know it, the musician has been hard to miss this year. He co-wrote Justin Bieber's biggest hit in years, Daisies, briefly appeared in the critically adored One Battle After Another, and released the warped, infectious R&B record Baby. A left-field pick for SNL, Dijon cycled through rousing renditions of Higher and Another Baby with his crew of regular collaborators, Nick Hakim, former Dirty Projectors vocalist guitarist Amber Kaufman, and Justin Vernon of Bon Iver. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Washington Post on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion section, I was a red state governor. What I saw at Harvard surprised me. The spirit of association remains alive in unexpected places. By Eric Holcomb. Eric Holcomb, a Republican, was the governor of Indiana from 2017 to 2025. In January, I completed 2 terms of governor of Indiana. This fall, I did what all red state Republicans do, right? Spent a semester teaching at Harvard University. As someone who believes that restoring our communities is among America's greatest challenges, my goal was to see if the foundation of an open-minded, problem-solving community still existed in a place far removed from my own cultural comfort zone. It does. Friends warned me that a den of woke lions would maul me or try to turn me into one of them. Neither happened. I suffered no grievous insults, surrendered none of my conservative principles, and witnessed no disruptive behavior on a quiet campus. Contrary to my side's worst fears, I found a community that didn't always agree but could still talk with each other and work together toward the greater good, which in Harvard's case includes education, discovery, and the development of ideas and technologies. To dismiss my experience, today's online denizens at both ends of the political horseshoe will probably come to the same conclusion. He must be a centrist squish aligned with Harvard's elite orthodoxy. I have long been and remain a low-tax fiscal conservative and supporter of free markets, highly skeptical of hyper-regulation, social engineering, and culture war fads. A peace through strength U.S. Navy veteran, pro-life, pro-liberty, and pro-faith. That's not the elite profile of late. Yes, Harvard offers courses that deconstruct the Western canon. It also features classes such as Using Markets to Solve Social Problems and Central Challenges of American National Security, taught by nonpartisan thinkers. Yes, you may still find the intellectual underpinnings of Harvard's embarrassing anti-Israel encampments in some clubs and faculty lounges. You will also find a new president, an observant Jew, who is making sure that similar disruptions of campus life and blatant anti-Semitism do not reappear, even as serious conservative speakers show up again. Yes, Harvard devotes some of its large government research funding to projects that people like me might roll their eyes at. It also uses taxpayer support to study ways of reducing the trauma of war injuries, replacing humans with robots on the battlefield, and developing radiation countermeasures, alongside nearly countless human health projects. For example, the university's Move Lab at its engineering school developed a robotic vest that helps restore stroke survivors' arm and shoulder movement. The lab is using a $5 million National Science Foundation grant to transition prototypes for widespread use by patients. What I've experienced may be a natural return to Harvard's more moderate bearings, following noisy displays of intolerance by campus agitators in recent years. Or it may be due to the Trump administration's forceful executive orders and fiscal pressure. Either way, and it's probably both, let's take the win and learn the broader lesson. From Ivy League campuses to neighborhood associations, service clubs, and faith-based groups, communities of all kinds can restore themselves, and they need to. An American Enterprise Institute survey of more than 6,500 Americans in 2024 found that the country's civic life has declined in every conceivable measure since the mid-20th century. The survey found that Americans who still take the most basic step out of their comfort zones, walking around their neighborhoods and talking to others, are much more likely to trust people. Trust, of course, is the first step to working with others in a strong community. To fix things, we need to put down our phones, meet in person across tribal lines, and seek common ground while respecting different ideas about how to get there. County by county, with Democrats and Republicans, that is how we achieved some of the nation's largest public health investments 2 years ago in Indiana, despite raw memories of pandemic-era standoffs. We approved a 1,500% increase in public health spending, expecting that a novel set of solutions, designed and driven by people who trust each other at the community level, will better reduce overall spending on health care. It costs less to keep people healthy than to intervene when they're sick. Success in restoring our communities will ensure America's ability to meet any other challenge. Failure will make us brittle and weak. The French philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville recognized this on his famous study tour of America nearly two centuries ago. In his resulting masterpiece, Democracy in America, Tocqueville marveled at our country's spirit of association. Harvard convinced me that the spirit of association remains alive in unexpected places. And if any of my friends on the left want introductions at service clubs, union locals, or churches in the red states, call me. Getting out of our comfort zones to restore communities works both ways. And from the health section, rural America relies on foreign doctors. Trump's visa fee shuts them out. The Trump administration's demand for companies to pay a $100,000 fee to hire an immigrant worker using an H-1B visa has created turmoil among rural health providers. By David O'Valley. Shelby, North Carolina. The overworked kidney doctors in this small town were supposed to get reinforcement this fall with the arrival of a new colleague from India. Patients already had appointments scheduled with the incoming nephrologist. Then the Trump administration demanded that companies pay a $100,000 visa fee to bring highly skilled workers from abroad, including doctors and medical professionals urgently needed in healthcare deserts. Nephrology associates of the Carolinas could no longer afford to sponsor the Indian kidney specialist, and it has not found an American well-suited for the job. 2 months after President Donald Trump signed the executive order restricting H-1B visas, soaring costs are roiling rural health care facilities that have long struggled to find staff. The fee increases for visa applicants, coupled with broader crackdowns on legal pathways for foreign-born workers, threatens a growing industry and jeopardizes patients who need timely care, according to labor experts and immigration lawyers. In Shelby, about an hour's drive west of Charlotte, the three kidney doctors came from abroad, two working on H-1B visas. But retaining talent in a rural region can be hard. Another H-1B doctor decamped to Los Angeles last summer, increasing the other's workload. Jose Mena, who came to the practice from Ecuador on an H-1B visa, hopes to stay long-term in Shelby with his wife and young daughter. But Menya, 35, said he is taxed by frequent week-long on-call rotations, which involve phone consultations and hospital visits throughout the night, depriving him of family time. If someone else leaves from the practice, I'll just leave too, Menya said. The new nephrologist, Vijaya Chikani, 30, remains with her parents in Hyderabad, India, while the practice awaits a response to its request for the Trump administration to waive the fee under a vague national interest exemption. "I'm stuck right now," Chelikhani said. "I want to start my job." In a statement, White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers said that the visa fee discourages companies from spamming the system and driving down wages, and gives certainty to those who want to bring high-skilled workers into our country, but who have been trampled on by abuses of the system. Desperate rural need. The H-1 visa program allows U.S. employers to hire workers with specialized training from abroad for up to 6 years if they cannot find American workers to fill the jobs. Previously, the fees had typically ranged between $460 and $1,000 for nonprofit healthcare facilities. Companies often sponsor those workers for permanent residency. Some of Trump's supporters have asserted that the program takes jobs from American workers, while left-leaning critics allege that companies exploit the workers for lower wages. Nearly 400,000 new or renewed H-1B visas were granted last fiscal year, according to federal immigration data, mostly to Indian immigrants. About 17,000 of those work in the health sector. These legal workers fill crucial gaps in rural and underserved regions, according to medical associations and healthcare researchers. Iowa, North Dakota, and West Virginia, states that overwhelmingly voted for Trump in the last three elections, lead the nation with the highest percentage of physicians who hold H-1B visas, according to a study published this year. Last year, the percentage of H-1B-sponsored doctors in rural counties was nearly twice the share in urban ones, according to research published in JAMA in October. Impoverished communities also had a significantly higher percentage of H-1B physicians, said lead author Michael Liu, a resident physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Liu himself works on a trainee visa from Canada and hopes to eventually remain in the United States on an H-1B visa. The most visible aspects of Trump's sweeping immigration policies have targeted undocumented immigrants, but the policies are also reshaping legal immigration. The White House implemented a travel ban on people from certain countries and has increased scrutiny of visa applications. Last month, the State Department said visa applicants can be denied over obesity, diabetes, or cancer. The crackdown comes as rural hospitals are bracing for cuts to Medicaid, the health insurance program for the poor run by states and the federal government. The administration's policies will devastate hospitals already burdened by complex visa rules and costly legal fees, predicted Mira Middavi, an immigration lawyer in Overland Park, Kansas, who represents Midwest medical providers. Qualified doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals are in demand worldwide, and the U.S. is becoming less and less attractive because we have these incredible hurdles, she said. As immigration rules tighten, the consequences are rippling through sectors already struggling with labor shortages, especially in rural areas. Those include North Dakota, where communities have not attracted enough U.S.-born candidates, said Alfred Sams, president of the Rough Rider Network, an association of 22 independent rural hospitals in the state. "My hospital is 10 miles away. The nearest stoplight is 80 miles away," said Sams, who lives in Bottineau near the Canadian border. "We also have winters that are 30 below zero." Rough Rider hospitals rely on foreign-born health care professionals and operate on a slim or negative margin, Sams said, making the $100,000 fee for one worker insurmountable. It's not just doctors. For decades, the United States has lacked enough nurses, but visas typically used by foreign-born nurses have a years-long backlog, making H-1B visas a quicker option, said Karen Tumlin, an attorney with the Justice Action Center, a nonprofit representing companies suing to overturn the fee. One health system in Louisiana involved in the lawsuit had more than 200 H-1B nurses lined up, which would now cost more than $20 million in fees, Tumlin said. It's just not doable, she said. The American Hospital Association and dozens of medical associations have lobbied the Trump administration to exempt health workers from the fee. Neither the Department of Homeland Security, which can grant exemptions, nor the White House answered questions about the trade group's request. Simon Hankinson, a senior immigration research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation and an H-1B critic, called the fee a step in the right direction toward reforming a program that he described as a crutch for industries to hire cheap labor. Long term, he said, the measure will push U.S. students toward the medical field and incentivize schools to expand programs. The labor market in America has to be able to adjust, Hankinson said. Colleen F. Molnar, who leads the healthcare practice at Garfinkel Immigration Law Firm in Charlotte and represents Nephrology Associates of the Carolinas, said Trump's proclamation and the guidance that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, issued for it are vague on exemptions. She is arguing that several of her clients qualify for exemptions based on the shortages of healthcare professionals in their communities, while other companies are pausing their sponsorships. It's definitely having a chilling effect, Molnar said. Uncertainty in North Carolina. In North Carolina, health systems say they are in dire need of medical technologists who analyze blood, urine, and other bodily fluids for abnormalities. Iredell Health System, serving Iredell County's mix of rural communities, suburban neighborhoods of Charlotte, commuters, and upscale lakefront homes, is asking USCIS to waive fees for a medical technologist from the Philippines. The woman would join a fellow Filipina technologist, April Joy Castaneto, 30, who arrived at the hospital in Statesville on an H-1B visa last year. Castaneto had a good job in her rural Philippine province, but wanted a better life, and now works the overnight shift processing samples and analyzing results in a humming, sophisticated lab that patients never see. As with many current H-1B holders, the president's September proclamation struck fear in Castaneto. She is delayed returning to the Philippines to visit family out of concern that immigration officials won't let her back in. Meanwhile, Shelakani, the kidney doctor hired to work in Shelby, remains stuck. After graduating from medical school in India, she arrived in the United States in 2020 on a trainee visa for a residency in Michigan and a 2-year nephrology fellowship in Alabama. To stay in the country longer, Shelakani agreed to work for 3 years in what the federal government has deemed a health professional shortage area. The federal government preliminarily authorized her to stay after the Shelby practice submitted documentation to show that it had contracted a recruiting service and advertised in numerous medical journals and websites, but got only 2 U.S. applicants. One wanted to work doing transplants, which local hospitals do not offer, and another had cycled through numerous jobs, said Michelle Waters, the practice office manager. Chelakani returned to India to visit family, believing she would stay only a few months while the H-1B paperwork was finalized. Her shoes, clothes, and furniture are still in storage in Charlotte. In Shelby, the uncertainty has cast a pall over the office, the only kidney specialist serving a region of more than 165,000 residents. The practice nearly shut down several years ago when it had only one doctor left, the owner, Muhammad Alam. Born in Bangladesh, he arrived on a trainee visa in the mid-1990s and moved to Shelby more than a decade later. He and his wife raised 3 daughters here, including one who's now a doctor in residency and another in medical school. While H-1B doctors have kept the practice operating, new patients face long waits because those with severe kidney disease take priority. Many dialysis patients, often elderly, cannot easily travel to the nearest big city, Charlotte, for hours-long treatments three times a week. As the population around Shelby grows, doctors are seeing more patients, and many younger ones with health problems that contribute to kidney disease, Almond said. His office is considering obtaining a loan to cover the visa and operating expenses. If we don't have this practice, patients will suffer, Alam said. From the well-being section, the do's and don'ts of giving gifts to kids, according to a pediatrician. Don't worry about spoiling kids with gifts. Instead, model gratitude and talk to them openly about why some gifts might not be appropriate. Guest column by Perry Kloss, MD. We're at that time of year when gifts are celebrated and advertised and planned. Children understand that part of the season is about brightly wrapped packages, but sometimes adults worry over the complexities of who gets what and who gives what and what the hidden messages might be. I talk this through with colleagues who practice general pediatrics, as I do, and also developmental behavioral pediatrics, and here's advice that might help you choose holiday gifts for the children in your life. 1. Do research safety risks and concerns around technology. This is especially true for gifts that incorporate new technologies such as AI. Be sure you know what the message that you want to get your child might be. If you aren't the child's parent, check with mom and dad before gifting tech, such as anything that incorporates AI or a smartphone or tablet. There might be a reason the child doesn't have one of those yet. You should also be aware that certain gifts might pose safety risks. That includes anything with button batteries or magnets. Small objects also pose a choking risk. Think tiny Legos for a toddler. When in doubt, follow the manufacturer's age recommendation. 2. Do have realistic expectations. Some gifts take a while to land. Don't expect a gift, especially a somewhat unexpected gift, to be the one thing the child wants to play with immediately. The exception with very young children is usually the box that something big came in, generally a sure hit. Very frequently, it's the unexpected item which lies dormant for a while in the child's life that ends up being the thing that's picked up later and investigated. 3. Do talk it through if the ask is too expensive or inappropriate. This is probably the hardest one, and it's got to be case by case, depending on the kind of gift and the family situation. It's okay to say frankly to your child that some particular item is too expensive or costs more than your family would spend on such a thing, the designer pocketbook for the middle school student. But it's also okay to consider bending the rules a little now and then if the actual cost isn't the problem so much as the idea of spending it on that particular item. Talk it through and explain your reasoning. So what should you say if your child says, "Other kids in my grade have one?" Have this conversation long before holiday gifts come up and keep on repeating your message. This is what we do in our family. Don't ask what the child would do if other kids in the class jumped off a bridge. It's a notoriously losing strategy. And be at least occasionally open to negotiation. 4. Don't be absolutely bound by what the child already has and knows. You should suit your gift to the child's interests and preferences. We all like to feel seen and known by the people who love us, but it's also okay to allow yourself to push the envelope a little. A new fantasy series, a different crafts kit. A good gift is something the child will enjoy. A great gift might be something a little unexpected that the child really comes to enjoy. So go ahead and give gifts that you enjoyed when you were young, the books you loved, the games you played. Don't assume they will automatically be out of date and uninteresting. They might work or they might not, but many kids will at least be a little intrigued by the idea of a parent, let alone a grandparent, as a child. And at the very least, there can be some entertaining stories told about those long ago children, and you can always reread the book yourself. 5. Don't overthink it. This is supposed to be fun for all concerned. As with many aspects of parenting, it's possible to overthink the politics and parenting strategies of gift giving. You can worry about whether to give way to a child's campaign for a gift that is too expensive or too old for you or otherwise inappropriate. But while these considerations might occasionally require some thought and discussion, first and foremost, the focus should be on celebration and at least a sprinkling of indulgence. Otherwise, what's the point? The point is supposed to be fun, pleasure, and enjoying a special occasion. That's why we ritualize gifts and wrap them and generally make a big deal out of it. 6. Don't worry about spoiling kids with gifts, but do teach them about gratitude and traditions. The task of setting limits goes way beyond giving and getting, or not getting, gifts, and holiday occasions shouldn't bear the whole weight of it. A child who is not otherwise super indulged or problematically entitled is not going to be spoiled by a gift here or there. Do weave messages about gratitude, about understanding privilege, about giving back all through your holiday season, and indeed through the texture of family life. Better yet, model these lessons for your child. Don't leave them to be attached only to gifts and boxes. Make it clear that it's about giving more than the gifts. Whatever your holiday traditions, the more ritual, the better. And if it's an occasion where everyone gets presents, it's always good to stretch it out, unwrap in turn, and admire what others have received. A child who truly appreciates even relatively lavish and generous gifts and shows that appreciation properly is not spoiled. Worry more about the child who demands gifts, lavish or modest, or grabs them or expects them as an entitlement. And you know the etiquette moral. Say thank you and mean it, and there's nothing like a handwritten thank you note. Giving gifts to children need not involve teaching them valuable lessons, though they will surely be learning at least a little about generosity, imaginativeness, reciprocity, and gratitude. It does not require improving their more moral characters. Good luck with that. It's about making special occasions special. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 8th issue of the Washington Post. Your reader has been Cheryl. Thank you for listening.